And our guest today, Chris Hillman, founding member of The Byrds, The Burrito Brothers, The Desert Rose Band, goes on and on and on, has a brand new book that will be out November 17th of 2020. The name of the book is Between Time. We're going to talk to Chris. We're going to have a lot of music from Chris Hillman. You've already heard some in the first part of the program. You're going to hear from Chris's latest album, solo project, Biden Time, came out in 2017. He does a new version of Old John Robertson, and it's called New Old John Robertson. You're going to like that. Then they'll get us right into our nice visit with Chris Hillman. And following that, I love this album so much. There's so much to choose from the library that encompasses Chris Hillman's career. But an album that he did with Herb Peterson a few years ago, live at Edwards Barn, is still just one of those magic moments. It's him and Herb. You're going to hear from that album after we conclude our discussion with Chris. Wait a minute. Sin City and Going Up Home. You're going to enjoy this a lot. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. I am really happy to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass a very special guest, Chris Hillman. How are you, Chris?
I'm great, Steve. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
I'm thrilled to have you on here. The occasion, I think, for our getting together this time is a new book. The title of the book is Time Between My Life as a Bird, a Burrito Brother, and Beyond, right?
Yeah. I love the that was added by Scott Ballmer, the head of the publishing wing of BMG, which it works out pretty well, actually, in the title.
It does. You have just enough alliteration, and you can't keep listing all the bands because you'd have to list, the Desert Rose Band, and you'd even have to go back to the Scottsville Squirrel Barkers. It'd go on and on and on, so I like that. The book you mentioned the book is on BMG. You can order it now. And I think it's available for delivery November 17th, 2020 is what I have in my notes. Does that sound accurate?
Okay.
Steve,
yes.
Right. Good. The book is it's a great telling of really your childhood, your growth from the music interest of folk, which then kind of blends into some rock and some bluegrass, and then out of that somewhere through the 60s, the Byrds and all the other things that are happening. But I would like to make this point. The introduction to the book, Chris, starts with a fire. The introduction to the book starts with a fire in 2017.
Yes. Scott Ballmer, once again, brilliant editor. He's a wonderful editor. And had that idea. Let's start this story with something. And the fire came to mind. I also said, or I had another idea that it'd be great to open the book with backstage at the Ed Sullivan Show, which was, of course, live and the biggest show in American television.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
At one point, and every Sunday night, everybody watched it. So
I was one of those.
I also thought about opening the book with me waiting backstage to go on and play and watching this man rehearse his German Shepherds in a circle, and I just thought it was fantastic. But the way Scott came up with the fire worked so well. It was such a strange period. From the time we turned that record in 2000, February 2017, thereabouts, and we had played the Music Cares show that was honoring Tom that year, and we played, that was the first time I'd ever played Wildflowers, really.
And you discussed that in the book.
Yeah, it was a great year, Steve. And then, I'm in Nashville with Connie and my wife, and we hear that on the news in the hotel television that he had died. I couldn't believe it. And that just was like so upsetting. And then he died. And then we finished the tour initially, I say in the book. I talk about I was going to cancel the next four shows. I was very upset. And then Roger McGuinn called me and he talked me out of it. And Roger and Tom were very close. As I've talked about this in the book. And basically, just back to the book, is rather than me going through the episodes in the book,
sure.
I'm talking about the wonderful relationships that I had and nurtured along in music, and that I still, those that are still with us, I'm still very close friends with. I'm close friends with David Crosby. I'm very close with Roger McGuinn, probably more so than David, but that's irrelevant. I mean, David and I get along great. I look at his daily mischief he gets into. It's always interesting. But he's a good guy, and most everybody I worked with were great people. And it was such a insidious business music, and not bluegrass necessarily, but just more of the rock and roll business. You had to really sort of be aware of the pitfalls. And there it is. And the only other thing I as you probably noticed, Steve, was that I did not denigrate anyone I worked with. I didn't have to say, well, he was a drug addict, and I couldn't work with him, and he died of heroin, this and that. I actually told the book company, I'm not giving you one of those books, those rock and roll star books, drug addiction, alcoholism, rehab, break up the band books. I'm not going to do that. My life was nice. I had a nice life and a wonderful family.
I will tell the listeners, I've read the book. Thank you for having your people get that to me before we could discuss it. And I can confirm everything that you're saying, Chris, is that everything is, bands, it's hard in the 60s to keep a band together. Let's skip to the mid-60s when the idea of the Byrds and the music that gave spawn to that, and then the Byrds gave rise to every kind of music out of Southern California and the country that was sort of a, I guess they would call it Americana now. I don't know if they had a term for it then, but so
they didn't have it. Steve, we had folk rock, country rock, jazz rock, rock and roll.
Yeah.
I mean, Americana is a wonderful term. It really does encompass all of it, and it's all folk music if you think about it.
Yeah, I mean that's what. It's played by folks. I don't know if it was Louis Armstrong or Miles Davis that said, if folks are playing music, it's folk music. So that, that's the end of that.
That's perfect. Yeah.
That starts off. The reason I bring up the beginning of the book, and I'm not going to go through the whole book because people want to buy it, but it's to me, here we are in 2020, and the book begins with that introduction from 2017, and there are still fires all around those parts of California, and you barely escaped. With your possession,
I've been haunted.
You have to be.
By fires my whole life, and it's funny. It's almost like you're going, "What's this correlation here?" But yeah, I mean, from the time I was three or four years old, and our house caught on fire, and then in the Byrds, I lost my house completely. The house I was renting, and it was terrible, and on and on, and that was, a couple of evacuations and this and that. And we were very blessed with our house in this fire. We lost our kitchen. We lost a little family room. And if not for a couple of Ventura County, where I live, Ventura County firemen who happened to be cruising up through the hillside where I lived and checking on things as the fire started to subside, but they saw my neighbor's balcony go into my kitchen window, and they just made a call. They just said, we can save this house, and they had just enough water on the trucks. And they broke the door down, and they put that fire out and did not spread, and we really were limited to a small area. Unfortunately, none of the fire hydrants worked. So that's the other story.
I
was in.
That's not a good thing because pumper trucks can only carry so much.
But I'm just was so over and grateful. These two guys, I mean, these firemen, and then I got to know them. They came by a week later, checked on the house. Got to know them. They're great guys. Anyway.
Yeah, sure. So the fires are happening again. Now there is one other incident of you in a fire, which I will leave to the reader to find because it's. Well, it's a fire more involving your person, I think it starts out. But the readers, I want the readers to read into that and find out. But I want to come back to this, confirming that there are difficult times in any rock band, especially the Byrds. Let's start with them first. Difficult things happen because of this incredible popularity and all the pressure that's put on the band. But throughout all of these, with that band, with the Flying Burrito Brothers. Several other bands. I noticed that you really seem to have a great memory of Manassas, which was Stephen Stills. as far as that. But you know, you're not denigrating anyone. The reason I want to come back, I want to make sure people understand exactly what you said.
Mm-hmm.
You're just talking about.
Oh, everybody I worked with in high regard.
Yeah.
Manassas is a wonderful band. Stills was at the top of his game back in the early 70s. And was a wonderful, wonderful musician. And I learned a lot from him.
I'd watch him.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that album was four sides, and they were all different. I mean, that's the album. I had the LP, and I've since found the CD. But it was like, oh, this is bluegrass, or this is this, and this. It just was a great compilation.
When we started, seriously, I went down to play a few sessions for a single album. He was doing another solo album, which did morph into a double LP and touching on different genres of music, but still, once again, related. All of those different styles of music were related, but it just turned into a great double album. And like I say, working with those guys, they were great players. And the one thing, and in hindsight, where we're all so brilliant, here I come from the Byrds playing 8 Miles High and So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, two killer tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And the Burritos, we had these great songs that Parsons and I wrote, but we were, I don't know what happened, where we just were so lazy in the execution. We could have, and I'm just in hindsight, could have recorded those better. But we didn't. It's okay. But I mean, the ultimate stamp of approval, of course, is other people cutting your songs. And I mean, here Dwight Yoakam and Katie Lang do Sin City, which I did last week. I was hosting the Petty Show for a week, and I put that song on the playlist, and they really nailed it. But that for someone to record one of your songs is pretty much, you know, the stamp of approval, really.
You know, and you mentioned that.
I didn't ask for anything more. It's not about money. It's not about anything, but that people respect what you're doing and hold it up in a good place, you know?
In the book, and people can read all about the progressions of your musical interest, your fascination with bluegrass and how you got into that and wind up being a mandolin player. It's all great stuff. But I don't want to tell the whole book. But I'm happy you're a bluegrass fan. We have a lot of listeners that are bluegrass fans. So all of that.
I do. I love it. Still, Steve. I couldn't keep up with some of these kids now to save my life. They're great players. They play fast and clean, and they're good. You know, you're going, wow. I'm sort of clinging to the old masters. I love Flat and Scruggs, Bill Monroe, the Stanley Brothers were probably on the top of the list for me. I just loved them, and actually the Squirrel Barkers, we played a lot of Stanley Brothers and Jimmy Martin. I missed that. It was so much fun. And Kenny Wirtz, our banjo player, he played like Ralph. He loved Ralph's playing, so he'd got that sound. It was great. So yeah, I still love bluegrass. I really love Steve that so many young kids are appreciative.
That's exactly where I was going. All of the young people that are now playing, and you know what? They're playing bluegrass, but a lot of them are playing old time string music. That's kind of working.
Exactly.
It's kind of like the whole bluegrass trend is starting over again from where it began.
It is. And better, but it's great. I love seeing that. And even in the case of Avett Brothers or Abbott Brothers or Mumford and Sons, where they take the instrumentation and then incorporate that into more of a contemporary, almost rock type song, you know.
I
like that too.
Oh yeah, I asked a very good friend of yours once on this show, Herb Peterson, who is someone that I've always had a great admiration for. What it was about the sound of California bluegrass that I could almost hear it, and it would be different from, let's say, Colorado, you know, the Deep South or the West or the East Coast. There was always a different feel to California sounds, and I'm not sure that we ever resolved it. Maybe we can't, but I just always thought it was a different sound, you know? I could tell.
It is a different sound.
It's okay. Yeah, so tell me how then, because I don't know the answer.
Well, I mean, it's far more noticeable in country music in California.
Well, that's true.
There's a little bit more of an edge, but the California bluegrass has that edge to it. I don't think there's that much of a big difference, and only in that just about everybody covers the old songs, right? So let's just say if a band in California is doing a Monroe song and a band in Virginia is doing a Monroe song, is it going to be that much different? Well, California, are we going to have an affected accent in doing the song? And or is that part of the presentation from a cultural standpoint? Now, one thing I will tell you, Herb and I, growing both native Californians, but we both had the opportunity to learn from guys from the South. I mean, Herb worked with Vernon Ray, who were out of, I believe, Arkansas. I worked with the Gosden brothers and Don Parmley. Don came from Kentucky, and Vernon Rex came from Alabama. So I always said that was my window on authenticity, because what Herb and I learned, this is very, very important, what we learned beyond the music, learning the music off of a record, we learned the culture. We learned how they thought, how they ate. But, you know, just they, we learned about the people and that part of the country where they grew up. And it opened up a lot more about the music than you normally would have gotten.
And it's
sitting in your room listening to a record.
No question. And I'm talking to Chris Hillman. So what you're, I think what you're saying is that it does open up that other part of it. But that's also part of the deep seed of the music itself. And it can be interpreted in a different way, but it does kind of come from that. That South, that kind of sound from...
But you really don't have to grow up in North Carolina.
No. No, yeah, you just... Yeah, but you took the opportunity to learn about it.
Well, yeah, but you don't have to... You can play music that's associated with certain parts of the country. Wherever you live, you can play that music and understand it. But the point is, with all of it is, okay, as I said, we all start out doing covers of the old songs of the Stanleys and the Monroe, because, you know, and I love those tunes, but the idea of it all is to get as much as you can from that and then expand on it. So whenever I would teach mandolin, I used to teach mandolin at Fur Peace Ranch for Yorma McCaukinen's music camp, and I would do beginning mandolin, but I'd always say, listen, I never learned rawhide or bluegrass breakdown note for note like Bill Monroe. I couldn't. I just was too lazy to figure out the tablature. But I would get 85 to 90% of it, and then I'd add the next 10% would be my own. So I didn't stray from the original arrangement of the song or anything, but I never could read tablature. I just didn't believe. And my point was, put some of yourself into the song.
Right.
Make what you're listening to, but add your own part to it and give it your own signature.
Well, I think
you
have to do that. You have to do that. And if you're skilled, you can do it. Yeah, you need to.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I want to take a minute here. I know I'm going to use these last couple minutes, but we're talking to Chris Hillman about the time in between my life as a bird, a burrito brother, and beyond. Lots of alliteration there. But throughout the book, early on in 1961, this is something that kind of, and it should shadow over your career, and you actually kind of, you resolve it as best you can later in the book. But in 1961, if you wouldn't mind speaking about the passing of your father.
No, I don't mind speaking about it at all. It did catch us all by surprise, and I had a feeling he was going through some bad times. He was a very good man. This was not a question of an abusive man, an alcoholic man, or anything. He was a good, hardworking, loving father, wonderful man. And he taught me, as he did my brother and sisters. They taught it. My mother and father taught us responsibility, working for things, morals, values, all of the above, everything you should teach your child, they taught us. So it was quite a shock when he died. And then suicide, anybody that has gone through it, will leave you very angry because you're being abandoned. And it's a selfish act. It's tough, but I did. It took me 30, 40 years to forgive him.
Yeah.
I forgave him.
Go ahead.
And, no, that's just basically it. And it was much better when I had finally let that go, because it was really something. I was so angry, and I couldn't pinpoint it why. I couldn't pinpoint why I was angry, but it was over the suicide, losing some of my loved ones, really, as we all loved him. But we survived. Let me just finish. We survived.
Absolutely.
Everybody in this family, and I remember my poor mother, as just before she passed, she said, I let you all down. I said, no, you didn't. I said, everyone in this family is successful. Because of you, we're all successful. My brother had a career as an airline pilot, and it was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. My older sister was a successful teacher, and my brother-in-law and my younger sister was everybody was successful. And point being, we survived a very egregious act and a very, very sad time, a tough time. But we had to, you know. When my father died, we had no money. We were broke. We didn't even know that. We didn't know there was no money. So what do, Steve, in those situations? You have, you go, okay, and you do it. And my mom said, okay, I was 17 years old. My sister was 14 or something. We were the last ones living in the house. We went to work, and I went to night school. That was what we had to do to survive, and we made it. And when I turned 18 and the squirrel barkers were beckoning, my mother, bless her heart, she says, go. She says, I know you want to do this. I know you'll survive. And the door is always open. Couldn't ask for a better parent.
No, you really couldn't.
And wasn't clinging to me and saying, you can't leave me. She said, go.
So
make it. Go get to you. I'm just expanding on that.
Yeah, sure.
The book basically, Steve, is the normal human condition of coming from a very dark or tough time as a child and coming through it and picking yourself up when you fall and keep going. And that's what it is. Like that old silly cliche, the road to success is filled with failure. I love the story of Michael Jordan not making his high school basketball team, if that is indeed a true story. I love that. Well, he didn't make the team. He wasn't good enough. And he, look what he turned
into. Yeah, really.
My God.
Well,
that's the story. I will have to check that and make sure I'm right.
You probably should. But I think it's true. But so, well, so the book, though, we touched on just a few parts. Things are resolved as you go through toward the end of the book.
Redemption.
Yeah, there's redemption in a lot of ways. And I want the people to read about the type of redemption in the last chapter. You kind of recount people that you've lost, which is something that we all do at an older age where you think about it. But throughout it all, Chris Hillman has gone through redemption. There's some very poignant moments in the last 30, 40 pages of the book, as there are throughout. But it's a wonderful story. If anyone is a fan of the Byrds or the Flying Burrito Brothers or the Desert Rose Band, just goes on and on and on. Chris, it's a great story. Dwight Yoakam writes one of the best forwards I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, man, Dwight is such a gifted writer.
What a writer.
I'm on him about he should do a book. He's an incredibly good writer, as well as he's also a heck of a good actor.
Yes,
he's
is.
He's not some musician trying to be an actor. He is a good actor. He was a drama major.
You know, was there a creepier guy other than his character in Sling Blade?
It's Sling Blade. It wasn't a stretch, because there was a time when I knew Dwight 25, 30 years ago, and he was that character.
Okay.
I wanted to strangle him, but now we've become really good friends. You know, we're very close.
Chris, I'm going to let you go. I know you're busy. Thanks so much for taking time to the audience of Unreal Bluegrass.
It was a pleasure talking to you. You're a good interviewer, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Listen, man,
thank you so
I appreciate
much.
It. It's a great book, and the last album. I would say do it together. Get the book. Get the Biden My Time, and I listen to a lot of Byrds and a lot of music, but that's the album I kept coming back to as I was finished reading it. It's just a great combination to have around. So
thank you.
I'm glad you're still
thank
doing
you
well.
Very much. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Bye.
All right, then. Bye-bye.